PhD dissertation at the University of London to Al-Ghadir, and I mean, its theme is concerned with the seminal role of Shias in the development of Arabic literature. It was entirely based on the first volume of Al-Ghadir. And when Dr. Safah Houloussi was developing his doctoral dissertation at the University of London, he used to come to Iraq to visit Allama Amini and his resources quite a lot of times.
And what a misfortune not to translate. And what a misfortune not to translate into English.
The issue is we have some people who are translating it in Urdu language. And they could, I think, translate 5 volumes of the Urdu. The main problem is the literature. You know, when you're translating, you can translate a book very easily.
Okay. Yes.
But the poetry cannot be transferred. Obviously, an ordinary person, or it needs really, you know,
A poet himself
who can understand like how it was written. And, you know, generally translating a script, a statement, a hadith or a Quranic, yes, or these things are very easy.
Easier.
And it's obviously 11 volumes, so it needs really dedicated.
A teamwork,
yes.
It needs a teamwork to translate. And Allama Amini himself was a team, I think.
I think there is the translation which I saw,
yes,
that team who was working on it, yes, they had a discussion like to translate the poetry, the Arabic poetry, into the Urdu poetry. So they were after this as well.
Okay.
So there are many things that are happening. Yes. They're going on. But obviously, until they reach to the, obviously, its final point, we cannot.
But in English, is still no valuable English.
Let me tell you very something. Good. Yes. So far as I know, there have been several Persian abridged editions of Al-Ghadir. Abridgments. Okay?
Yes.
I can say that. I mean, I'm 100% sure that there hasn't been any abridged edition of Al-Ghadir unless I found it, read it.
Okay.
The best abridged edition of Al-Ghadir is the one done by the sons of Allama Amini, because they were aware and they were together with the father, Allama Amini, who was developing Al-Ghadir.
Yes.
This abridged edition done by, the sons of Allama Amini, it was translated into English. This abridged edition was translated into English.
Yes.
But unfortunately, the translation is really awful.
Mm-hmm. The really quality is awful. Not good,
Yes, full of mistakes.
Full of mistakes,
Unfortunately.
When you search the Google for the English translation of Al-Ghadir, you find nothing.
Yes.
I mean, the only thing is a summary.
It's not been published.
Yeah. It has not been done yet, yeah. I think. And this is really a misfortune, I think, for the Islamic world and the Shia world, you kind of not to have the translation of this, not only in English, but in different languages, but in English still we cannot see. And I hope and I wish and I pray that one day the English translation, the good quality English translation will be done.
Some people suggested me to translate Al-Ghadir, but I said to them that, apart from Quranic verses and hadiths, how would you go about translating a very noble Arabic poetry, when you translate a poem from one language into another language, nothing exists, nothing remains, everything is lost.
Okay, that's all right. Yes. I hope that Dr. Fakhwani, one day you would do that, isn't it? the English translation.
I guess it must be my own project.
It would be really difficult, but now for those listeners who want to be more familiar with Allama Amini in English language, I really invite them to read out your book, Dr. Fakhwani, Devoted to the Truth, Allama Amini, the author of Al-Ghadir, written by Dr. Mohammad Reza Fakhwani and published by The Sun Behind the Clouds publication. This is really a good book. Professor Liaghat Takim from the McMaster University in Canada says, and I'm reading the back cover of this book, "This work is an invaluable resource that the general readers and the students of Islamic disciplines will benefit from." Dr. Fakhwani, thank you very much for writing this book, and thank you very much for your presence in the program. Teacher, which was about Allama Abdul Hussein Amini, may Allah bless his soul, and the magnum opus that he wrote, Al-Qadir, will remain, I think, during whole history of Islam and the Shia Islam, and the coming generation will benefit from him and the other books of Allama Abdul Hussein Amini. Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, thank you much too, brother.
You're welcome.
It was very kind of you. beautiful information and fruitful discussion by you and Dr. Mirza Fakhruhani. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher, which was about Allama Abdul Hussein Amini, the author of the magnum opus, Al-Ghadir. Visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page, also our YouTube channel, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
In the limelight.
As recently as 2019, the FBI used surveillance tools intended for tracking foreign terrorists and spies in unrelated domestic crime investigations involving Americans without even seeking secret warrants from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, FISA Court. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Scott Shackford Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Report Says FBI Misused Foreign Surveillance Powers to Investigate Domestic Crimes. Stay tuned, please, for the details. As recently as 2019, the FBI used surveillance tools intended for tracking foreign terrorists and spies in unrelated domestic crime investigations involving Americans without even seeking secret warrants from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, FISA Court. The information comes from a recent certification report from the FISA Court itself, written in November, but declassified and released by the Office of Director of National Intelligence recently. The report documents 40 instances in which the FBI secretly accessed data collected not about foreigners but about American citizens for investigations of healthcare fraud, transnational organized crime, violent gangs, domestic terrorism involving racially motivated violent extremists, as well as investigations connected to public corruption and bribery. Though it is the FBI's job to investigate such crimes, in these instances, they did so using data collected under the Section 702 authorities of FISA, which does not permit targeting Americans for these types of investigations. Section 702 specifically focuses on unwarranted searches of foreign targets because they don't have the protections of the Fourth Amendment and therefore their communications can be collected and reviewed. Even with that clearance, the FISA court exists to make certain that the FBI and National Security Agency do not abuse their access against Americans, which is exactly what happened here. When Congress renewed Section 702's authorities in 2018, they actually codified permission to use this part of the law for domestic surveillance for certain types of crimes, like human trafficking. Yet the FBI still misapplied it. Nevertheless, despite these violations of procedure and of Americans' privacy, the FISA court went ahead and renewed federal certification for this section, 702 surveillance. The explanation as to why actually goes back to a completely different FBI violation. When the agency screwed up its search warrants to the FISA court when surveilling Carter Page, former Trump campaign aide, as part of the investigation into whether Donald Trump or people in his orbit had been compromised by agents, they got permission to wiretap Page's communications, but the FBI cut corners on the warrant applications and omitted information that likely would have raised questions as to whether the surveillance was justified. And a subsequent audit from the Office of the Inspector General for the Department of Justice found that the FBI routinely made errors in its warrant request to the FISA court when asking to surveil Americans. After those problems were publicly revealed in 2019, the FISA court ordered the FBI to submit a formal plan for fixing them. Director Chris Wray responded with a 40-point training plan to correct FBI surveillance procedures so that they are compliant with privacy protections for Americans. This latest FISA court report notes that these newly discovered violations took place before Wray's training program was implemented. So, as FISA court judge James Bolsberg explains in the report, they are going to assume until they discover otherwise that Wray's reforms fixed these problems. "I'm not kidding," Bolsberg writes. "The court finds that the proposed procedures, as reasonably expected to be implemented, comply with applicable statutory and Fourth Amendment requirements." That feels like a massive shrug, given the number of mistakes the FBI has been making in both submitting proper FISA warrants and in snooping through Americans' data without warrants. But the recertification in this report comes with strings attached. Both work is ordering quarterly reports detailing each instance in which FBI personnel accessed Section 702, acquired information about an American that wasn't for the purpose of foreign intelligence gathering, what information is used for, precisely how it happened, and whether it was consistent with their 702 authorities. The increased transparency about how this FISA court surveillance works due to both reforms that followed Edward Snowden's disclosures as well as attention brought by the investigation of Trump's campaign has been a boon to the public in understanding that this system is far from perfect. As we can see, even with this more visible oversight, the FBI keeps making mistakes that violate Americans' Fourth Amendment protections against warrantless searches. It's something to remember whenever anybody attempts to argue that the FBI needs more authority or more laws to combat domestic terrorism. It is not properly respecting the limits on the power it already has.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
سبحان الله والحمد لله لا إله إلا الله والله أكبر لا إله إلا الله.
Let's listen to the famous reciters of the Holy Quran in the month of Allah.
سبحان الله
Brother Muhammad Reza Birya, only in IRIB English Radio.
In the name of Allah, Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters in faith. Welcome to this segment of the month of Allah. In this segment of the show, we're going to talk about famous reciters of the Quran, both Egyptian and Iranian reciters. One of the great reciters who is very famous is, without a doubt, Sheikh Abdul Basit Muhammad Abdul Samad. This great reciter was born in 1927. You know, in the 1920s, many great reciters were born. Reciters such as Sheikh Muhammad Siddiq al-Minshawi, Sheikh Kamil Yusuf al-Bahtimi, Sheikh Abu al-Ainain Shu'aisha, Sheikh Abdul Basit, Sheikh Hamd al-Zamir, and also Sheikh Ahmad Amir. He was born in 1927. His father was a teacher of Tajweed. He knew Tajweed of the Quran, and he was also a Hafiz. Sheikh Abdul Basit Muhammad Abdul Samad memorized the whole Quran at an early age, just like most reciters from Egypt. I think it's very good that all those who want to be reciters of the Quran and recite the Quran melodiously, they should first try to memorize the whole Quran. This is something that Shahat Muhammad Anwar, the famous reciter, also had advised all of the Iranians when he visited Iran. He said that you should first try to memorize the whole Quran, learn the Tajweed, and also Maqamat, and then you will become a good reciter of the Quran. When Sheikh Abdul Basit Abdul Samad was just 12 years old, he would recite the Quran in Quran gatherings. Sheikh Abdul Basit visited many Muslim and non-Muslim countries, and many non-Muslims, by listening to the recitation of Sheikh Abdul Basit, converted to Islam. That's how influential and beautiful his recitation was. It's been said that Sheikh Abdul Basit is a dhahabul khalis, meaning pure gold. His voice is pure gold. His voice is very beautiful. It's silky smooth, and that is what makes him very famous throughout the world. In fact, the first reciter whom the entire world became familiar with, especially Muslims, was Sheikh Abdul Basit. If you go into the streets and ask people, name me one reciter of the Quran, they will say Sheikh Abdul Basit. This great reciter passed away in 1988 from diabetes. May Allah bless him and reward him. Now we're going to listen to the recitation of Surah Al-Tariq by Sheikh Abdul Basit Muhammad Abdul Samad. Let's enjoy this recitation.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. والسماء والطارق وما أدراك ما الطارق النجم الثاقب إن كل نفس لما فلينظر الإنسان مما خلق خلق من ماء دافق يخرج من بين الصلب يوم تبلى السرائر فما له من قوة ولا ناصر والسماء ذات الرجع قول فصل وما هو بالهزل إنهم يكيدون كيدا وأكيد كيدا فمهل الكافرين
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful, by the sky and the night comer. And what can make you know what is the night comer? It is the piercing star. There is no soul but that it has over it a protector. So let man observe from what he was created. He was created from a fluid, ejected, emerging from between the backbone and the ribs. Indeed, Allah, to return him to life, is able. The day when secrets will be put on trial, then man will have no power or any helper. By the sky which returns rain, and by the earth which cracks open, indeed, the Quran is a decisive statement, and it is not amusement. Indeed, they are planning a plan, but I am planning a plan. So allow time for the disbelievers. Leave them a while.
حياتي American politician and lawyer Elliot Abrams, who has served in a number of U.S. administrations, has proposed to improve American foreign policy. In an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, Abrams argued that the U.S. is at a critical crossroads when it comes to the defense of American freedom, security, and prosperity. Abrams says around the world, the U.S. faces significant national security threats, among them revisionist powers, the spread of nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons, and transnational terrorism, which are all made more dangerous by renewed great power competition with China. Abrams believes none of those challenges will disappear if America abandons the international role it has maintained since World War II as what he called a superpower leader of the free world. Abrams also says that is why he is joining with 75 other national security scholars and practitioners to launch the Vandenberg Coalition, a new network committed to advancing what has been described as a strong and proud American foreign policy. But what is this war party and what purpose does it serve?
We will eliminate all of these people with this dual loyalty, like Elliot Abrams. Elliot Abrams is the son of Norman Podoretz, a son-in-law of Norman Podoretz and Mitch Decter, a classic neocon, a man who's willing to break the laws of the United States of America in the interest of Israel. He had to get a pardon in order to get his job, his security clearance. We need to have a clear dividing line here between the people who serve Israel, like Elliot Abrams, who serve Israel's interests, and the people who serve America's interests.
Many believe this sounds more like the project for the new American century. PNAC, which was active between the years of 1997 and 2006, was a new conservative think tank whose goal was to promote American global leadership. The group openly advocated for total global military domination, and many PNAC members held highest level positions in the George W. Bush administration.
Yes, that's exactly what it is. Nothing has changed except the labels. These people were, for some reason, they didn't like Donald Trump. I don't understand this. He did everything that Israel wanted. But the problem here is that these people are always using front groups. They're always trying to disguise themselves as an American this or Republican that or conservative this. All of these labels are covers, they're disguises for the fact that these are Jews pursuing Jewish interests. The interest of the state of Israel and not the interest of the United States of America.
Elliot Abrams' proposal comes as the United States has already been actively engaged in multiple confrontations in the Middle East and East Asia. It's now a decades-long war on countries like Afghanistan and Iraq, and even Syria have led to nothing but deaths and destruction. The wars cost America trillions of dollars. However, numerous military manufacturers, including Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, and Northrop Grumman, have large contributions to U.S. wars by profiting the most from them. This is why growing arms investments mean a lot for international relations. Many believe this may be the reason behind the creation of the project suggested by Abrams. Meanwhile, Washington has been at a trade war with China for some years. It has also been initiating a potential altercation by keeping its presence in the South China Sea and other areas in the region. It seems that such comments by the likes of Abrams only serve the U.S. military manufacturers and the deep state, which support forever wars, as opposed to the policy of the new administration of President Joe Biden.
But if you're talking about America's interests, You're disguising once again the fact that this is Israel's interest, these are Jewish interests. And yeah, there is a military industrial complex that profits from wars, that's true. But that all disguises the fact that what Elliot Abrams really represented here. So as I said at the beginning, I think this is a good idea. I think they should form a Jewish party. If you want Jewish interests, if you want America to serve Jewish interests, then vote for Elliot Abrams and all of his formerly known as neoconservative friends.
Biden's reluctance to continue down the path of neocons and other warmongers in the U.S. ruling establishment aside, the U.S. is practically unable to keep going down that road. On the other hand, multiple U.S. wars waged over the past decades indicate that the United States is a warning power, as it has not won any of them. Yet Washington wants to continue his wars and his costs. Most observers, strategists, and political scientists, as well as sitting and former officials in the U.S. and the wider West, believe that America's clout has long been under decline and the country is no longer capable of acting like the good cop it has portrayed itself to be.
New allegations are swirling around British Prime Minister Boris Johnson about misusing funds received from Conservative Party donations. The Prime Minister stands accused of infringing the law by using the funds to renovate his residence at No. 11 Downing Street. The allegation has prompted an Electoral Commission probe into the matter, which can take months to complete. Johnson maintains that he has personally paid for the costs of the renovation.
Who initially, and Prime Minister, initially is the key word here, who initially paid for the redecoration of his Downing Street flat?
As for the latest stuff that he's bringing up, he should know that I've paid for Downing Street refurbishment personally, Mr. Speaker, and I contrast it. Any further declaration that I have to make, I will, I will be advised upon by Lord Guy.
However, the British Prime Minister did not clarify whether he initially made the payments.
Well, if any of the three reviews into his conduct find that he broke the ministerial code, then Johnson would be expected to resign, but just expected, is how it says. But the code has already proved useless, really, like in the case of Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon, but she did a lot worse. But really, I don't think the Electoral Commission, which is investigating, is conducting at least one of the investigations, will really want to bring down the leader of an elected government with a large majority.
The latest allegation, which is referred to by the British media as the sleaze row, comes only days before local elections across the country are scheduled to be held. A recent opinion poll now shows the ruling Conservatives are losing their lead over the opposition Labour Party. Apart from the redecoration scandal, there have been other unconfirmed reports that the Conservative Party donors have been solicited funds for personal matters. The Sunday Times has cited a British MP as saying that he had received a complaint from a donor who was asked to pay for Boris Johnson's child's nanny. A spokesperson for the Prime Minister's office dismissed the report, saying Johnson had paid all the childcare costs himself, but she didn't respond to a question about who had initially made the payment. But that's not the only report tarnishing the Prime Minister's image. He's recently being grilled about whether or not he had said he would rather see bodies piled up in their thousands than declare another nationwide lockdown. Remarks he flatly rejects ever making.
Prime Minister.
No, Mr. Speaker, and I think the Right Honourable Gentleman is a lawyer, I'm given to understand. I think that if he's going to repeat allegations like that, he should come to this House and substantiate those allegations and say where he heard them and who exactly is supposed to have said those. Who exactly is supposed to have said those things, Mr. Speaker? Because I certainly can tell him, and he asked about the October decisions, they were very bitter.
The rules on parliamentarians' expenses were really tightened up more than 10 years ago, and a few MPs were forced to resign over that. But that means that a lot of the Westminster sleaze that we used to talk about all the time has been eliminated. I think the reason that this has become such a big issue is that the Labour Party opposition doesn't have any clear policies or even really broad politics.
Tories are now debating who's behind the leaks, with the majority of fingers now pointing at former aide to the Prime Minister, Dominic Cummins. In the meantime, the opposition Labour Party has accused the government of showing contempt against the British people by engaging in such infightings.
An audit by the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, has revealed that Washington's effort in February 2019 to send aid to Venezuela was part of a plot to change the legitimate government of President Nicolas Maduro in the oil-rich Latin American country. The USAID report noted that the aid offer was not planned in alignment with humanitarian principles, but for supporting pro-Western figure Juan Guaido. That is while Venezuela was grappling with chronic shortages of food and medicine. The document said materials sent to the Colombian border region in February 2019 were planned to be distributed by the allies of Venezuelan opposition figure Juan Guaido to reinforce his credibility. The U.S. administration, under the former President Donald Trump, planned for the aid supplies to be carried out by Guaido's allies across the Colombian border into Venezuela. However, the Venezuelan government blocked the aid convoys at the time, calling the U.S. move a violation of the country's sovereignty. In reaction to the audit, the Venezuelan Foreign Minister Jorge Arreaza said the U.S. offered aid to the oil-rich nation 2 years ago in a bid to overthrow the government in Caracas. Also, the Venezuelan Information Minister Freddy Nunez called the so-called U.S. humanitarian support an excuse in which Washington sought to break Venezuela's territorial sovereignty. Venezuela descended into political turmoil after opposition figure Juan Guaido unilaterally declared himself as the interim president in January 2019. He claimed Maduro's re-election in 2018 was fraudulent. The Trump administration recognized Guaido as the legitimate leader of Venezuela and publicly pursued a regime change policy against Maduro. Meanwhile, the Biden administration has reaffirmed the U.S. recognition of Guaido as the interim president and has ruled out negotiations with Maduro anytime soon. Washington has been pursuing a regime change in Venezuela and has imposed crippling sanctions on the country to force Maduro out of power. The organization USAID has been accused of political interference in the past. It has used aid and the notion of democracy promotion to interfere in countries like Russia and Cuba. Venezuela has been no exception.
Well, I would say yes, the U.S. does lose credibility when its plans get exposed, but that won't deter the United States from trying to push forward these plans. Really, what we have in the U.S. is there's one end goal, one end interest, and that interest is in the interest of imperialism, of trying to open up markets and take resources from other nations that the U.S. either does not have enough of or would want to have more of. One of those resources in terms of Venezuela being oil.
The U.S. has been after regime change in Venezuela for quite some time, especially during the presidency of the former president Hugo Chavez, who was very vociferous in its anti-U.S. stance. The U.S. has refrained from recognizing Nicolas Maduro's re-election in 2018, freezing millions of dollars of Venezuelan money in U.S. bank accounts, and imposing sanctions on the crisis of the economy of the Latin American nation. What has been termed as economic terrorism, Washington is attempting to use sanctions as a leverage to overthrow the legitimate government of Maduro. Last month, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro slammed Washington's plan to transfer $150 million of the country's frozen funds from offshore accounts to the opposition led by Juan Guaido. Maduro lashed out at both the U.S. government and the Venezuelan opposition, calling them a pile of gangster bandits. While freezing assets and slapping illegal sanctions on countries that refuse to submit to Washington's hegemonic policies is nothing new. The U.S. sanctions have directly targeted Venezuelan people who are stuck between the coronavirus pandemic and an economic crisis. There's also the case of the failed U.S.-backed coup plot. Venezuelan security forces arrested dozens of people, including two Americans, after a beach invasion allegedly aimed to overthrow President Nicolas Maduro. This was a plot which involved U.S.-backed opposition leader Juan Guaido. A Florida-based ex-Green Beret, Jordan Goodreau, told the Associated Press that he was working with the two American men in a mission launched early to liberate Venezuela.
I would point out that a lot of these failures are contemporary. They're things that are happening recently, and not to say that they weren't failures in the past, but we've seen how a lot of the regime change efforts in the past were far more successful than they have been recently. I think part of the problem for the United States, at least, is that the world is becoming a lot stronger and a lot more aware of some of the tactics that the United States is using.
Like other countries in South America, Venezuela is facing a harsh new pandemic wave, fueled by more infectious virus variants coming from neighboring Brazil. Experts say the sanctions, used as a tool for regime change, have no effect on the stability of the Maduro administration, but impact the socioeconomic condition of ordinary people amidst the COVID-19 crisis.
first Palestinian national election in 15 years has been indefinitely delayed. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas made the announcement following a meeting with Ramallah-based political factions on Thursday. Abbas blamed Israel and the uncertainty about whether it would allow the vote to take place in the occupied West Bank and Gaza for the decision.
Facing this difficult situation, we decided to postpone the date of holding legislative elections until the participation of Jerusalem and its people is guaranteed. Jerusalem will not be compromised, and our people in Jerusalem will not give up their right to exercise their democratic rights.
The decision came 3 months after he issued a formal decree ordering a vote for the Palestinian legislature on May 22nd, and a Palestinian presidential election on July 31st, votes that could serve as an acid test for the legitimacy of the Palestinian political institutions, including his own presidency. Many observers believe the indefinite postponement is effectively a cancellation of the vote.
In my opinion, the best thing the Palestinian Authority can do is to dissolve itself. Anyone who tries to represent Palestinians today is compromised in some way, either because they are cooperating with the Israeli occupiers and oppressors, or because they can only operate if they're opposing them, as Hamas is. They can operate only within certain parameters because they're denied the ability to operate the way they would like to operate.
Hundreds of Palestinians staged a protest in Ramallah to denounce the decision. They chanted slogans calling for the formation of a legitimate government. Earlier in the day, hundreds of people had staged rallies in the Gaza Strip to condemn the Palestinian Authority chief's plans to call off the vote. The Palestinian resistance movement, Hamas, denounced Abbas's decision, calling it, quote, a coup. In a statement, Hamas said the move goes against the path of partnership and national consensus, issues that cannot be pawned as collateral for the agenda of a faction. It also noted that the Fatah movement and the Palestinian president bear full responsibility for the decision and its consequence. In a separate statement, head of Hamas Political Bureau, Ismail Haniyeh, condemned as unconvincing the decision, demanding that the elections of the Legislative Council, the Palestinian Authority, and the National Council be held at agreed schedules. He added that the resistance movement is ready to cooperate with all Palestinian political factions.
A Hamas win might be satisfying to many. It might be satisfying in the sense that it confronts Israel and that it stands up for Palestinian rights. But in fact, a Hamas win means probably more oppression and less opportunity from the Israeli side, and it very possibly will be used as a pretext for Israel to be even more oppressive and to accelerate their genocide and ethnic cleansing of Palestine, because their ultimate objective is to have no Palestinians in Palestine.
Israeli authorities have made many efforts to either cancel or postpone the polls. Israeli forces have escalated an arrest campaign targeting key Hamas figures in the West Bank in recent months. Observers are drawing a parallel between the recent arrests and those made in the run-up to the 2006 elections, which resulted in a sweeping victory for Hamas.
The Light.
An exhibition in the Belgian province of Wallon-Brabant has put on display several objects belonging to French Emperor Napoleon Bonaparte. A belt with the word Waterloo written on it, a flintlock pistol, Napoleon's shoe, bathtub, clothes, and several other objects are all displayed in the exhibition. Many of the items are brought from Napoleon's last residence on St. Helena Island. The curators say the exhibition aims to show Napoleon's daily life and the way he lived. Earlier this week, an auction was set up in France offering Napoleon's blood-stained cloth, estimated to be sold for $18,000. May 5th marks the 200th anniversary of Napoleon's death. Over the past few years, people have become more aware of the detrimental effect of littering to the environment. Bolivians have launched a nationwide campaign aimed at protecting the country's scenic spots and waterways from human waste. Hundreds of volunteers were seen cleaning up the Valley of the Souls near La Paz, which is famous for its unusual razor-sharp rock formations. The volunteers, aided by heavy machinery, managed to collect over 15 tons of plastic waste and construction rubble from the rocky canyon. Activist Carola says people needed to speak up more in defense of the nature, which is increasingly coming under threat.
It is incredible how we can find jewels like this painting amid all these piles of rubble and garbage, and we are surprised and ask, what is going on with nature? It is a tourist place where many people come. The Valley of the Souls is very special, and many people have gathered together here to be a voice for nature and to get it the care and respect it deserves.
Last month, the campaign also cleared the highland lake of Uru in western Bolivia, which is said to be full of more plastic than water. Campaigners say they will continue their efforts until no place with garbage is left in the country. People always try to find new ways to connect and support each other at the moment of crisis. A young Indian is one such example who is saving lives by providing free oxygen to coronavirus patients. A 32-year-old Shanawaz Sheikh is a resident of India's commercial hub, Mumbai. He launched the campaign during the first wave of the pandemic when his friend's cousin died of COVID-19 on the way to hospital. Now popularly known as Oxygen Man, Shanawaz sold his car last June and used the money to buy oxygen cylinders for those in need. He and his team have now set up a control room to deliver oxygen to patients. They send the cylinder as soon as they receive a call from a COVID patient or a family.
Without oxygen, a patient can't live. They need it very badly, even in the ambulance on the way to hospital. If Shanawaz wasn't helping, patients would likely not even make it to hospitals. They would die on the way.
Shanawaz says his team helped nearly 5,000 people during the first wave of the pandemic last year and is planning to help as many as possible during the second wave. His initiative is earning him much praise on social media, with many calling Shanawaz and his team real heroes during the crisis.
Archaeologists have found a meaning for mysterious new findings in a cave in Mexico. They believe they are part of ancient Maya rituals. Around 1,200 years ago, some people imprinted their hands on the cave walls. The 137 prints are in two colors, black and red. Experts say the black ones represent death, while the red paintings are a reference to war or life. An analysis of their size also shows that the handprints were likely made by children as they entered puberty. The subterranean cavern, called Chichen Itza, is located nearly 10 meters below a tree which Mayans assume sacred. Little hotels for little bees. In Colombia, wooden structures are built for the insects to rest after a hard day. The Oboro Valley Metropolitan Authority has installed the hexagon-shaped rooms for bees of all shapes and sizes. Every day, volunteers clean the bamboo hotel with paintbrushes. Designers say the bee hotels are made to protect some species that are more vulnerable.
These little bees are supremely sensitive to poisons, and since they don't produce honey, no one speaks up for them. So we're coming to the rescue.
Designers say bees are losing their habitat all over the world, so the hotels could be a means of survival. Colombia has registered 550 varieties of bees within its borders. In Britain, a revolutionary idea might change many things in regard to maritime boarding operations, a jet suit. This is what the Royal Marines are testing in a variety of scenarios. Wearing the jet suit, each person can fly freely over the water and land on a moving ship. Its developer company, Gravity Industries, says the suit provides quick access to any part of a target vessel. Previously, British paramedics had tested the unique product for search and rescue operations. The suit can reach a speed of 51 kilometers and a height of over 3,600 meters.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Now, the 200th death anniversary of French Emperor Napoleon Bonaparte has brought a unique opportunity for private collectors to buy his DNA. The auction offers Napoleon's blood-stained cloth, which is estimated to be sold for $18,000. The collection will also include a lock of the French Emperor's hair, a pair of his stockings, a shirt with an embroidered letter N, and other items of clothing.
In my opinion, Napoleon was the first to want to create a Napoleon brand, even when he was alive. He created an image, a symbol, a look, with his hat worn in reverse. It was a very ordinary hat, an ordinary coat, but he was a very good communicator, and he created his image. So generation after generation, we kept this image of Napoleon, his hat, and this contributed to the myth. But it was Napoleon who wanted from the beginning to create an image, a look.
Nearly 360 objects will go under the hammer in the upcoming auction. Many of the items are brought back from Napoleon's last residence on St. Helena Island. Historians say his belongings have sparked the passion of collectors in France and other parts of the world. Several years ago, one of the French emperor's signature bicorn hats was sold to a Korean food industry mogul for more than $2 million. A Belgian chocolate maker has come up with the idea of chocolate bunnies in the shape of vaccine syringes to spread hope during the coronavirus pandemic. Geneviève Trapon makes the chocolate bunnies at her workshop in a village south of Brussels. She has dubbed the chocolate syringes Lache à Aztec. I hope I pronounced that correctly. This is not the first time the Belgian confectioner has been inspired by the pandemic to create art. Last year, she also put white masks on its Easter bunnies to keep the spirit alive amid a worsening pandemic. Trapon says she came up with the idea of syringe-shaped bunnies after the first coronavirus inoculations in her country at the end of 2020.
Why did I decide to create the chocolate vaccine? We are still in a period of COVID-19, and it was the logical continuation of the little masked rabbit from last year. Back then, nobody was talking about vaccines. At the end of that year, we started talking about a vaccine, and I thought the rabbit should be vaccinated. It's a symbol of hope, and that's why I decided to create the vaccine.
Trapon says her works show natural health benefits of chocolate. She believes that the chocolate version, like a real vaccine, has enough positive effects such as anti-depression, nutrients, and magnesium. Many of us have missed air traveling, though, due to the coronavirus pandemic. Now, a South Korean airline has opened a restaurant offering in-flight meals on land. The Jeju Air restaurant resembles being in a flight with mock plane windows and boarding gates. It serves popular onboard meals such as rice and chicken. Customers have hailed the creative idea, saying the experience reminds them of the joy of travel. Having food in the imaginary flight costs around $9 for each person. The temporary diner will run for the next 3 months. Let's go to the Philippines to meet a man having a big, colorful collection of Happy Meal toys. Percival Log has been into collecting toys since he was five. His collection includes around 20,000 toys from fast food restaurant chains like McDonald's and Burger King. Log also holds a Guinness World Record from 2014. The 50-year-old graphic artist says he always takes good care of his beloved toys. He believes each toy has a story inside.
Toy is like a storyteller in itself. Like, for example, it gives me a glimpse of that particular period when I got it, my story, what's going on, what are the incidents that are attached in the acquisition of that particular toy.
Luke says his family and friends also help him broaden his collection by donating toys. He hopes to display his toy collection for the public to, quote, give people a chance to revisit their childhood memories.
People around the world have been grounded by the coronavirus, with many being forced to work from home. But the Scottish man has made his secluded cliffside a perfect spot against a pandemic-induced change to working habits. Jason Griffin's 34-year-old call center consultant from Glasgow has put remote working technology to the test by moving his office to a dangling shelf off the Irish Sea. His move is seen as an attempt to give rise to the digital nomad, meaning people can use technology to work from wherever connectivity is possible. Griffin says as long as there is a mobile connection and his laptop, he has everything he needs to do his job.
Today we are pushing the technology to its limits because we're going over a cliff face, and we're abseiling down to a ledge, and I will be working all day from that ledge and taking and making calls, interacting with internal staff, just showing that remote literally means remote.
Griffins has set up a temporary office on a cliff face to prove that its performance is as good as a busy office. Call centers are one sector where remote working and technology has kept companies connected to customers. But the digital revolution has seen an inclination towards working remotely.
IRIB English Radio.